accession number 28361, Reel 1.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 1.
Can you tell me if there was a tradition of military service in your family?
No, there wasn't a tradition in that sense. My father fought in both world wars, but actually he was an architect. He was in the artist rifles before the First World War in one of the artists or architects companies, and being an architect, he was an architect's company as a private soldier. The artist rifles in those days was commanded by the president of the Royal Academy, and he was 26 when the First World War broke out, and went to France as a private in November 1914 and was commissioned into the 1st Battalion Scots Guards in January 1915 and finished the war as the Brigade Major of the 19th Infantry Brigade, and then went back to being an architect, got bored, I think, with working for his father's practice in London, and took up the opportunity of a partnership in a firm of architects in Calcutta. And in the Second World War, he joined the Indian Engineers and built airfields in the Arakan. And that was why, because he was in Calcutta, I was born in Calcutta.
When you were growing up, did you do any military or paramilitary training?
Well, the only paramilitary training I did was at school, at Sherborne, in the CCF. In those days, you had to join the CCF. There was no option. It was actually quite useful joining the CCF because it prepared you for the next thing, which you all had to do, which was national service.
What years were you at school then?
Well, I was at school in Sherborne from 1948 to 1952. Before that, I'd been at a prep school in Sherborne, and before that, I'd been at school in India. So I didn't leave India until I was 11. In the normal course of events, I would have been sent back, like all other little boys, to prep school at the age of about 8. But when I was 8, it was 1942, and little boys had pretty low priority on ships coming back to England in 1942. And in any case, I think my parents thought they didn't want to risk that I might be torpedoed or I might not be seen again. So I went to school in India.
In Calcutta?
No. What happened was that schools were opened up in hill stations to cater for children who'd been prevented from going back to the school in England. And in the school that I have ended up in was in Kashmir and was really a sort of annex to an existing mission school that had been there for a long time. And it was run really on English prep school lines.
You were very young, but presumably you were becoming more aware of things in general. Were you aware of changes in the political atmosphere and conditions in India towards the time of your departure?
Not really. My parents discussed it, but I was far too busy doing other things. The sort of things that I did become aware of, for example, was the Great Bengal Famine of 1942, because you could actually see, when you drove around, the results of this terrible famine, which killed a large number of people. People died of starvation and disease, and one saw some of the effects of that. The big riots that had started in India between the two religious communities hadn't really got underway by the time I left, which was at the end of 1945, because I arrived back in England on Christmas Eve 1945, and all those troubles really brewed up in the subsequent years, and so I wasn't aware of them as a child out there, quite honestly.
Can you remember what impression you got of England when you first arrived?
Well, I arrived in Tilbury Docks, as I said, on Christmas Eve 1945, and most of Tilbury Docks was smashed flat in the Blitz. And so I remember in this bus going past what was, to a child, see miles and miles and miles of bomb-damaged houses and blitzed streets, and then going to Victoria Station and getting on a train, by which time it was dark, and going down to, with my parents, because they came back with me, to my aunt's house in Sussex, and I remember thinking that it was cold, dark, and a bit dreary.
Was there ice on the inside of the bedroom window when you woke up in the morning?
I don't remember there being ice on the inside of the bedroom window when I woke up in the morning, but there was certainly ice on the bedroom windows of my prep school, which I went to, certainly in that terrible winter of 1947, which I remember very well.
When you were in the CCF at Sherborne, can you remember what you learned? What was the syllabus of training?
Well, the syllabus of training was aimed at getting you past a thing called Cert A, Certificate A, which was deemed to be an important step when you went and started doing your national service, because it was something you could, whether it actually was important or not, I don't know, but it was sold to us as being important, and it would give us, as it were, a step up when we came to our national service. I doubt very much if it actually did. And the sort of training you did was drill, quite a lot of that. You did basic field craft and tactics. You then progressed to section and platoon level tactics. I don't think we ever did anything as complicated as a company attack. And of course, what you've got to remember is a lot of the masters who ran the CCF had been in the Second World War, and some of them had been very distinguished soldiers in the Second World War. Almost all the younger masters had been in the Army, Navy or Air Force, and so we had chaps who'd been in the Guards Armoured Division, chaps who'd been in tanks, chaps who'd been in the Airborne Division, and it was actually quite, we were rather sort of, how should we say it, snobbish little boys. We would sort of look around and see what regiments they'd been in, how many medals they had, and whether we deemed that they'd done their bit or not. But the facts of life were that they were some quite experienced people taking the CCF, and I expect never before nor since have CCFs been run by so many people who'd been in battle and knew what it was about.
Do you remember any individuals in particular?
Well, I remember one particular chap who was the naval CCF commander who'd been in frigates and destroyers in the Second World War, and was a very sort of ebullient character. He also coached the 2nd 15 rugger as well, and he was a thrusting sort of type, and one can imagine him sort of on the bridge of a destroyer going in to sink a U-boat. And at that time, of course, the book by Nicholas Montserrat about the war in the Atlantic, The Cruel Sea, had just come out, and so we were sort of continually trying to divert him during maths lessons to ask him questions about the Cruel Sea. Was it like that, sir?
What did he say?
Well, he was actually, he would sometimes get drawn and say, yes, it was actually quite an accurate description.
And you mentioned platoon tactics. What, do you think the platoon tactics you were taught were drawn from the personal experience of those teaching, or drawn from the standard War Office pamphlet?
As far as I can make out, they were drawn from the standard War Office pamphlet, which, as I recall, had been revised during the war, and therefore presumably was reasonably up to date.
You mentioned drill, basic field craft tactics. What about weapon training, map reading, the other?
Yes, we did map reading. We taught map reading, which actually did come extremely handy when I joined the Royal Marines, because you didn't have to start from a baseline of nothing. You knew quite a reasonable amount about rudimentary map reading. We did weapon training on the old Lee Enfield 303, not the number 4, which we then got, of course, when we joined, but the old SMLE, the First World War version. We did training on the Bren, and we had to pass tests on the Bren, and I remember in the changing room of my house we had a drill Bren, and we used to put ourselves through the IAs on the Bren in the changing room. And we did also some shooting, but mainly sub-caliber 2.2 shooting on the range, and there was a range in the school. And certainly we used to shoot about once a week.
Sounds like it was really quite a thorough basic training.
Yes, it was. I think that the CCFs in those days took themselves quite seriously because of the two factors that I imagine my school was no exception. In every school there were chaps who had been in the war and therefore could pass on their experiences, and the secondly because of the ever looming threat, if you like, of national service, so that on the whole it paid you to pay attention.
Again, you were growing up at the time when the Korean War was breaking out and being fought and conscription was retained and rearmament was started. Did those events have any impact on your consciousness?
Oh yes, because I can remember exactly when the Korean War broke out, and then we read the newspapers, and there was no television in those days. We used to listen to the radio in our studies and listen to the news, and of course we had elder brothers, and I didn't have an elder brother, but other chaps had elder brothers and fathers and uncles and so forth who were actually involved in the Korean War, so it did impinge, and what is more, there was always a chance that your friends would join regiments that were eventually going to end up in Korea. So, yes, you were conscious of it.
Were you inclined towards a military career yourself while you were at school?
Well, I, at one stage, thought I was going to join the army, but I did actually rather incline towards the Royal Marines, but at that stage you had to pass physics to get into the Royal Marines, which I was extremely bad at. And so my prospects of joining the Royal Marines were zero until they removed the requirement to have physics. So the only reason I went into the Royal Marines was because they suddenly decided they wouldn't have physics as a requirement. In those days, no such thing as A-levels. You took a thing called the Civil Service Commission Exam, which was, I think, an exam taken by the civil service as well, hence its name, as for all three armed services. I can't remember, but there were something like five or six papers that you had to sit. And boys who were going to go into the Army, Navy, or Air Force went into a thing which was called the Army class, where you just crammed for 2 years to pass these particular exams.
So did you go into that class yourself? You
oh, yes.
The Army class?
Yes, everyone who was going to the Army, Navy, or Air Force was aspired to went into the Army class, yes. After you'd taken what were then not O levels, because they didn't exist either, but school certificate, as it was called.
You did the school army class and then took the civil service commission exam. And what was the next stage after that? Did you apply to the Marines before or after?
Before. And I'd heard I'd passed, and you then went for an interview. In a thing called the Admiralty Interview Board, which still exists to this day, which in those days was held down in Dartmouth. And this was preceded by a medical in London. Your eyesight was tested and all various other things were tested. And the Admiralty Interview Board was very much like it is today and not dissimilar from the regular Commissioners Board, consisting of interviews, discussions which you were required to lead or take part in, what are called command tasks, where you were required to get your team of chaps from A to B across a crocodile-infested river in theory, which was actually in the gymnasium, using an assortment of planks and ropes and rubber tires and so forth to test your leadership qualities.
This is a matter of reef knots and cantilevers, isn't it?
Yes, it is, really. The object was to see if you could solve the problem you were presented with.
Was it under time pressure?
Yes, it was. Mm. Yes, I can't remember how much time you had, but not much.
Mm. That seems to be the essence of the system, the Regular Commissions Board for the Army, that it's a partly complicated task. You have to organise people, and you have to do it within a relatively short space of time.
Yes, it's exactly that on the AIB. I suspect it's much more sophisticated now. The AIB, as far as I remember, lasted about a day and a half. Mm. I think it's much longer nowadays.
Was the medical a very thorough one?
I think it was pretty thorough. It's very difficult for me to tell. I mean, they test your eyesight, your ears, teeth, nose, breathing. They gave you a sort of MOT, I think.
And do you remember what you were asked in your final interview as part of the Admiralty Interview Board process?
The one question I remember being asked was what effect the Romans had on Britain. This was by the resident headmaster on the board, and why the Romans had come to Britain in the first place, which was something that slightly threw me, as I hadn't actually studied Roman history for a very long time. And so I made up a few answers which apparently satisfied them, including that they must have come looking for the tin in Cornwall. Well, that seemed to satisfy them.
And what happened next then?
Well, after that, I went back to school and was told that I'd passed and that I would be required to present myself for basic officer training at what was then the infantry training centre at Limpston in Devon in the new year. Now, this is sort of September 1952, and then suddenly the Royal Marines decided to call forward my intake and join it with the intake, or batch as we used to call it, that was joining in November. And to my father's fury, since he'd already paid the term's fees, I was whisked out of Sherborne halfway through the term and joined at Limpston. So one week I was a schoolboy, enjoying myself playing in the first 15. The next week I found myself at Limpston to start my basic officer training.
You said your father was furious about you leaving school early after he'd paid up. What did he think in general terms about you joining the Marines?
Oh, he was very happy with that. No, I mean, he wasn't furious about joining the Royal Marines. He was just irritated that he'd paid a term's fees and then it was only get half a term's worth.
You arrived at Limpston with your badge. How many of you were there in the badge?
There were 14 of us, which for those days was actually quite a large batch. And as I said, it was actually the amalgamation of what I think had been originally two, and was also, I think, the result of this removal of the requirement to pass physics, because half my batch had passed it under the old regime, and the other more thicker members, including myself, had passed it under the less rigorous regime.
On first sight, prima facie, could you tell the difference between the physicists and the non-physicists?
No, you couldn't tell the difference at all. And we were all more or less the same age, and all very young by today's standards. I mean, I was 18 years and a month old. My birthday was on the 7th of October, 1952, my 18th birthday, and I was joining on the 9th of November, 52. And we were all, I think I was the second youngest in my batch, but not most of them were about the same age as me, and the exceptions were people who were about to reach the enormous age of 20.
What sort of chaps were they?
Well, they were all
members of the batch.
They were all people who'd been to a public school, and in that respect, again, of course, it's very, very unusual. And I don't know why that was, but it was that way. They were all people like me, with the sort of backgrounds. Their fathers were lawyers or doctors or architects or that sort of background.
Professional background.
We had a couple of Etonians, we had a Harrovian, we had a range of people from various British public schools. And I think we were very representative of the sort of middle class boys of the 1950s.
What did they do with you on this initial training?
Well, the initial training was 18 months long, and it was really divided into three parts with other things added on, but the aim was to train you first how to be an ordinary Marine, how to keep your kit clean, how to carry out drill, how to take your place as a rifleman in an infantry section. And so you dug slip trenches, you went on march, you did lots of physical training, huge amount of emphasis on PT, leading eventually to what they call battle PT, BBT, which you did in your boots and combat kit, whereas PT was done in gym shoes and shorts and vests. A lot of drill, because the Royal Marines prided themselves on their drill, and we were under the tutelage of a man who, in the Foot Guards, would probably be called the drill sergeant, but in the Royal Marines was called the first drill, who was a warrant officer class 2 and a very meticulous man. There was not a lot of sort of beasting. There was a lot of very rigorous requirement to pay attention to detail, to have your kit immaculate. And I can remember we used to parade as the days went by in full, what was then battle order or fighting order, which the Royal Marines used to keep, they didn't blanco it, It was cleaned with black boot polish. And it had, I think, something like 78 individual bits of brass on it, all of which had to be immaculately cleaned, of course. And cleaning your kit took up most of your night evening after supper. You could spend 3 to 4 hours a night just getting your kit ready for the next day, and that's what we did.
What time in the morning did the day start? Morning?
Well, the day started reasonably civilized way. I think the parade, the fall-in would sound at 8 in the morning, so you get up around 7, put the final finishing touches to your kit, and then you'd form up, and we learned very early on that the time for being anywhere was 5 minutes before that time. I mean, it was absolutely no good whatsoever turning up at 8 o'clock. If you weren't by the side of the parade ready to march on at 5:02, you were late. So punctuality was something that was drilled and drummed into our heads. So it was basic training, really, and a lot of range work, passing your basic weapon tests and so forth, and on rifle, which was the number 4 rifle then, and Bren, the old 303 Bren, and 2-inch mortar we came on to, of course, rocket launchers we fired, the old Lifebuoy flamethrower we used, grenade throwing, all the basic infantry weapons.
You're up at 8. What time are you normally able to turn in at night when you've finished all your combats for the next
Seldom morning? Before midnight, and often later, because of keeping your... The kit cleaning was really quite a sweat.
Did you find the discipline hard to accept, or was it something you took to... easily and naturally?
I didn't actually find it hard to accept at all. I think this is because we'd been at a school where we were quite well disciplined. I don't think my fellows found it difficult. I don't remember it being hard to accept. In fact, it was quite fun being in an adult world from being in a boyish world. I found it rather, and being among, you know, grown-ups was much more stimulating than being at school, I thought.
You mentioned PT and the battle PT. Now, in PT, you can emphasise various things: agility, endurance, strength. Was there an emphasis on one of those particular qualities?
The main purpose of the PT, as far as I can recall, was to build us up for the battle PT, which was to follow. And so they were looking for very quick reactions, instant obedience to, you know, get off the floor, hang from the ceiling on your heads and things like that. I mean, rather silly things, but do it at once. Stretching us to do, you know, jumping over wooden box horses, a lot of upper body work on ropes and pull-ups to prepare us for the battle PT and, of course, the assault courses, which were there as well. And the impression I got is they were trying to bring us up to a standard which would enable us to go on to the next phase, which was the battle PT and, of course, the assault courses.
So what was the battle PT then? You mentioned you were doing it in boots and fighting gear, as opposed to gym, the gymnasium, gym shoes and a singlet. So what was the... How did the content differ?
Well, the content differed in that you it was outside in the field, and you were wearing boots and battle gear, and you had your weapon, your rifle. So you were doing things like carrying other people in firemen's lifts. You were doing runs with your rifle. You were doing exercises with the rifle. I can remember when you sort of held the rifle out at full arm's length and did things like this round your head, the aim being to strengthen you up, and there were specific pre-shooting exercises that you did, like holding the rifle with one hand, pulling it into your shoulder, and holding it steady to teach you to pull it in with the right hand. Now, the BBT, or battle PT phase, didn't last long, because the next phase was going on to assault courses proper, which were the traditional kind of assault course where you clambered over walls and went through tunnels and climbed nets and jumped off things and did that. So the battle PT was really a preparation for the next bit.
So it was a progressive development in three stages.
Yeah.
Did you suffer from any strains or injuries as a result of this?
No, I didn't.
program?
There didn't seem to be. What I know happened when I, years later when I was running Royal Marine training, was the thing that actually bugged us were these things like shin splints and tendonitis and other forms of injury. Now, I don't know why we didn't get those things. Maybe we had them, we just thought they were aches and pains and thought nothing of them. Maybe because we played a lot of sport before we got there. It didn't affect us.
They ask if you were fit before you arrived.
Yes, I mean, I was as fit as I thought I was fit. I was reasonably fit. I'd been in a reasonably good unbeaten rugby team as a hooker. I'd bowl. And I thought I was reasonably fit. In fact, I learned that I wasn't as fit as I thought I was, but I think I was okay.
What about the other people in the batch? Did they all manage to get through this?
Yes, yes. Again, we had some good games players. I mean, we had a chap who was a first class cricketer, rugger player, etc. We had a chap who had been the captain of boxing at Eton. And it was quite an amusing story where one of the colour sergeants said to him, come here, Mr. Mennell, you know, come spar with me. And Mr. Mennell knocked out the colour sergeant. So we were all pretty, because I suppose we came from a culture where sport was.
How did the colour sergeant take to being knocked out?
He put out, actually.
Was he a marine colour sergeant?
I think he would have probably knocked out Mr. Ellis and Mr. Ferocity.
Were organised games a part of the physical training process?
Yes, there were organised games, and of course we were only 14 strong. What we did was we played for the training centre teams, depending on whether we were cricketers or rugby players or whatever. And also we were required to box in the Novices Championships. Everybody was there, whether they wanted to or not.
Was there a particular emphasis on boxing then?
No, there wasn't. It was just that you were required as part of the sort of rite of passage to take part in the Novices Boxing Competition.
So in some establishments, most notably Sandhurst, there is a case made for boxing that it is a way of fostering aggression.
Yes, there's a case made for milling, I think, rather than boxing. We didn't do any milling at all, and boxing didn't really form a huge part of our physical curriculum, but I remember it.
How long did this basic training go on, the Marines training?
Well, after we'd done about 6 months, which brought us up to about section commander standard, we were able then to take command of our own sections. And we also, another thing, the advantage of doing it there, where of course our recruits were being trained, we would then start joining in with recruit squads and start being their section commanders on exercises. And at this stage, and I'm now talking about May 1953, when we've been there since November, we all went to the commando school, as it was called, which was in a different place at Bickley, near Plymouth. And that was to qualify us to get our green berets. And you marched there. In fact, you didn't march the whole way from Exeter to just outside Plymouth. You were dropped off on the sort of fringes of Dartmoor. Truck took you there, and then you marched up the road in threes, and then halfway there you were taken under command by the commando instructors, and the other people handed their charges over to them, and we bivvied in a round wood near, I think it was two bridges, with the squad that we were going to be with, which was a squad of regulars. Because in those days there were National Service and regular. The Marines actually had more regulars than National Service. We had about, I suppose, 60% regulars and 30% National Service. And this was a regular squad who'd been under training by the stage we joined them for something like 24 weeks. They spent 12 weeks at the depot at Deal, followed by 12 weeks at Limpston. And we then joined them and were among them as part of the squad to march to Bickley.
What numbers were there?
I think the squad must have been about 40 strong. Mm. So we were about 50 plus. Mm. And the instructors, I remember, announcing that they intended to be at Bickley. And I can't remember exactly how far it was. It must have been about 15 miles. They intended to be in Bickley by what the Royal Marines was called stand-easy time, i.e. coffee break time. So we'd better get a move on.